Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'll be speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is January 20th, 2011. Thank you to all our hundreds of listeners. It's just gratifying to know that so many people are getting the message. And there's going to be some specials every first Thursday of each month. We're going to have our friend who came on the last show, Greg Glazer, a specialist in constitutional law. He's going to be with us the first Thursday of each month. Don't forget to friend, favorite, download the archive of the shows so that you can conveniently listen to them in your car, on your iPod or iTunes or your computer. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Debbie. How are you doing today?
Doing great. So happy to have you with me today and continue to study and learn the legal rights that people have in the instances of vaccinations. And would you like to do the quote for today?
Be glad to. And you picked out, as you always do, an awesome one. This is one from Alexander Hamilton, and it is, "Constitutions should consist only of general provisions. The reason is that they must necessarily be permanent and that they cannot calculate for the possible change of things."
Yay, Alexander. So, last week we were talking about our fears and how that really motivates us or limits or inhibits us. On the positive side, we can overcome our fears and move forward by taking action once we recognize and face them.
You know, a lot of those fears, Debbie, often come or are associated with confusion or misunderstanding about the Constitution that has to do with this very point in the quote here, that Constitution should consist of only general provisions. Now, Alexander's quote here seems to be geared at the recognition that we don't know what the future will bring, and so the Constitution needs to be flexible enough in having generalized language that it can adapt to an unpredictable, changing future. And there's sort of this tension historically with the Constitution and arguments on both or all sides or many sides as to whether or not the intentions of the framers, we hear phrases like that often, you know, they intended this or thought that. And I'm always thinking every time I hear that phrase, it's just sort of a general response in my own mind is, well, okay, maybe that's what the framers were thinking then, but does that mean that's how we should be trying to apply the Constitution now? So there are strict constructionists and various other phrases referring to people's philosophical views about whether the Constitution should be applied in a way that is consistent with what people believe the framers intended, although I'm sure there's debate on that particular point as well as in terms of what they actually intended. But there's, I think, an equally valid question as to, well, should we try to interpret a document written a couple hundred years ago in terms of what the people at that time thought, or do we look at it in a whole different way now because times are very different? So these kinds of debates go on about how it's applied. But the fact that there is general language, for example, with the topic of vaccines, there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says anything about vaccines. So how can we figure out whether or not we have rights under the Constitution pertaining to vaccines? And if so, what are those rights? And in general, I mean, this is a problem we have with statutes and regulations as well as constitutions, state and federal constitutions and constitutional provisions, that when these particular laws don't tell us exactly what to do in a particular situation or a particular topic, they may still have relevance to the topic, but we figure out how they apply and in what situations and circumstances, what way they apply, by looking to legal precedent. And legal precedent is something that is constantly growing and evolving, growing in quantity, evolving, and occasionally legal precedent overturns prior legal precedent. And so it's something to really understand the complete law on any point. You might start with a constitutional provision or a statute or regulation, but to really know, you have to look at the legal precedent too, because that's what tells us how the Constitution or any constitutional provision or a regulation or statute for that matter, how they apply in particular situations.
Wow. I think every single time we talk, we always go back to that, these particular points, that we must go back to the what is written and what the precedent is and how they had a conversation back then about what how to make a determination on that particular issue at the time. And so we always go back to those historical figures who have really looked very deeply into the Constitution and what are our the rights of the people. I also wanted to say that we learned so much from our historical figures, and that's why I took the quote from Alexander Hamilton. He really does address the dynamism of our Constitution, is what you're saying, to be able to adapt to the changes in society. And it was written to accommodate a time of upheaval during his age, and he had the foresight of, as you said, you never know what's going to happen in your future. And that's why, perhaps that's what he was thinking. And we don't know because we're not in his mind. But we think that about the ever-changing and rapidly changing of our technologies today. And just imagine the setting in which Alexander Hamilton lived back in the mid-1700s to the brand new 19th century. Alexander Hamilton was the first United States Secretary of the Treasury. He was a founding father, an economist that was concerned with the funding of the state debts by the federal government. That sounds kind of familiar. The same economic issues were of concern during his day when he established the National Bank, a system of tariffs, and friendly trade relations with Britain. And so we're dealing with so many similar issues. He was a well-read political philosopher, and it is no wonder that General George Washington chose him as his personal secretary during the American Revolutionary War. That was 1775 to 1783. So, he really was living in a time of change and revolution. And we, in a way, we are also. I'll let you jump in there.
Well, I was just going to say, in one sense, you know, Hamilton's quote refers to general provisions, and I'm wondering if maybe a better way to frame the issue he was going at there, or an additional way perhaps, I'm not trying to one-up Alexander Hamilton, but that it might be abstract versus concrete. The more concrete kind of a specifics you have, the more you risk limiting yourself to the current day and time. There was a provision, I think, in our own state constitution that referred to an actual monetary number. I don't remember the exact content, but I remember thinking when reading that provision, whoever wrote this was not thinking in terms of something as simple as inflation over the years. This, I mean, we generally think of constitutions as being not necessarily, I mean, constitutions are amendable. It can be changed. But you want something that as much as reasonably possible establishes fundamental principles, fundamental rights and obligations, fundamental structure. And those, the kinds of things that are generally going to be more enduring over the long term are going to be either more general statements or principles or assertions, or perhaps more abstract ones.
Right. I'm understanding you. So the more broad you make it, the more flexibility you have to make changes within that broad statement. Just kind of like our polycrest in homeopathy.
Well, you can have a general, you can have a general statement that people have, you know, religious freedom, but what does that mean in any given instance, for example, with vaccine religious exemptions? And again, we look to the statutes, regulations, legal precedent to get more specificity out of that. But in terms of the right under the U.S. Constitution, that would be primarily coming out of legal precedent. But you can have some very specific abstract ideas, but if it's a concrete, you know, again, the example, you're naming a dollar amount rather than a concept, maybe money in relation to something else. In other words, not naming an exact dollar figure. You know, and I'm just making this up, but, you know, somebody cannot go to jail unless they're, and in our society, we no longer, thank God, this was not the case in earlier times, for example, in England, but today you can't go to jail just for being in debt.
Okay.
But if there were going to jail for owing somebody money, you know, maybe there would be something that said you can't go to jail unless you owe someone more than $20. Well, 50 years later, $20 is nothing.
Right.
You know, and we see some changes in this. For example, in North Carolina, small claims court used to be only cases up to $4,000, but after inflation and after a while, they changed that to $5,000, and over time, it'll go up again, I'm sure, at some point. Not because in substance the figure is increasing, but because of inflation, the number doesn't have the same meaning that it used to have. Well, if you have something that concrete in a constitutional provision, it doesn't have the flexibility to change. If you say, if you're referring to a dollar in terms, a dollar amount, not in terms of a precise number, but in terms of some relationship to economy in some other way, then it's a very specific, potentially, but somewhat abstract reference, but nonetheless one that's flexible to adapt to the times. I'm sort of getting off the point here. Let's try and reel this back into vaccine rights, which is what
we do want to talk about. I mean, you could very well segue into the ability to travel, foreign travel, your freedom to move about. I mean, did the people during his day and age have those freedoms, and how does it relate to vaccinations and traveling today?
Well, one of the fascinating things we have in this country as a political system is we have individual state governments and state court systems and state rights, and then we have a separate federal system with federal laws and federal rights. And in many cases, an instance, a situation involves only state law, and then it would, if it were formally disputed, it would only be in a state court. And we have federal law issues that will only ever be in federal court. And we have some issues that are a mixture of state and federal law. And vaccine religious exemptions is a real good example of that. They are often, not always, but often the starting place is a state statute. For example, school enrollment, vaccine requirements, and exemptions are going to all be on the state law except for military schools or some other federal context. But for the majority of us, most of the time, we're dealing with state law. But as soon as the state enacts a religious exemption statute as a state law, federal First Amendment rights automatically attach to that. Part of our First Amendment in the federal Constitution is the so-called free exercise of religion. It's a very general phrase, and so harking back to Alexander Hamilton, appropriate in the way that he was suggesting, or consistent with what he suggested, and I think appropriate as well. But what that actually means in terms of vaccines and vaccine religious exemptions, we have to look to legal precedent to see. But we have the ability to freely travel within our country. You can cross over from Nevada into California or one state into any other adjacent state, and you're not going to have to show a passport or anything else to do that. We can travel freely all around the country, within the country.
Even to Hawaii.
Even to Hawaii.
I'd like a trip there.
Let's do the next show from Hawaii. What do you say? But
it's an idea.
Leave it on the table. But it's a different matter when you travel between countries. For purposes of vaccine rights, though, the only time that we might see some kind of issue traveling between states, if there were some sort of national declared emergency, the ability to travel between states necessarily invokes and involves federal law. And so hypothetically, if there were a national infectious disease emergency of some kind called, then there could potentially be monitoring of state border crossings. But generally speaking, absent some sort of extreme emergency situation, we're not going to see that happen as any sort of routine measure. Not the same thing when you get into foreign travel. Now, in the same way, as an analogy, in the same way that once you start involving more than one state, you know, if a criminal commits a law in North Carolina and stays in North Carolina, it's probably, unless he's committing some federal crime, it's probably a state law issue. But even if it's a state law issue, if he jumps over into another state, it could involve federal law because it involves more than one state. And there's a similar sort of thing that comes up with travel between countries. Every country has its own ability to have whatever requirements it wants to have in terms of vaccines, and as that might pertain to people coming into a country from another country. But for international travel, that's a domain that falls under the jurisdiction of the World Health Organization. Now, almost all the countries in the world have signed on to this. It's something that I don't think there's any agency that has authority to require the countries of the world to participate in this. But as a practical matter, all the countries in the world, or most of the countries in the world, have signed on to this and say, yes, we agree to follow the World Health Organization's guidelines as it pertains to international travel. So I get the question in a lot of my practice, and the CDC has a long list of recommendations for vaccines above and beyond the regular routine immunizations for foreign travel. But within the World Health Organization's international health regulations, as it pertains to international travel, there really is only one vaccine that's required in a fairly limited circumstance, and that is yellow fever for people traveling whose travel involves going in and out of particular countries in sub-Saharan Africa and tropical South America, where yellow fever is a concern, is an ongoing concern. So the CDC keeps information about this on their website, and that's reliable information, although, of course, many people concerned with foreign travel will treat the recommended vaccines as a requirement, informally at least, and assume and expect that everybody will get vaccines. But you have a potentially different situation or another component if you have an employer. Say you're employed by a company here in the U.S. and your work involves overseas travel. And the employer says, well, to keep your job here, you have to get such and such a vaccine. Might not be required under the international health regulations, and the United States can't pass laws telling you what vaccines you have to get to go to another country. But maybe your employer says, well, if you're going to work for us, you need to get these vaccines. And that can raise potentially another question or another area of law that can involve or potentially a couple of areas. If it's a government employer, you even have the potentially the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or if it's in a particular one of the dozen or so states, perhaps more, that have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you may have some leverage there. These Religious Freedom Restoration Acts at state and federal level say, in effect, and I'm sure I'm paraphrasing here, but if a government is going to impose on religious beliefs and practices, they have to meet two conditions. The first, there has to be a compelling state interest, and probably vaccines would qualify for that, and they have to do it in the least restrictive manner. Well, in this country, we have exemptions in just about every, well, medical exemptions in any context in which vaccines are required, religious exemptions in the vast majority of contexts in which vaccines are required. So if somebody's beliefs, objections to vaccines include religious beliefs, then they may have some rights under these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts if they're in a jurisdiction where that applies. And they're not available everywhere to everybody, but in some states and in the federal law level as well. But there's also a part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. A component of that is Title VII, and then a section of Title VII, which requires employers to reasonably accommodate their employees' religious beliefs. And I get this all the time, or this is the law I use frequently when I'm working with healthcare employees. But I think the same law could have application if an employer is saying, you're traveling overseas, you need to get these vaccines. And assuming we're not talking about yellow fever and going in and out of sub-Saharan Africa or tropical South America where these this is relevant concern, because the international health regulations do not have a religious exemption. They offer a medical exception or exemption to that, but not a religious or philosophical one. So it's a limited requirement, but within the requirement, a very limited exception. Just generally, we could do a whole show about what qualifies for religious beliefs or what doesn't and related mm-hmm. issues there. But just generally speaking, what qualifies is very broad. It doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion or which one you belong to if you do.
I think we may have covered a couple of those things in the previous talks that we've had, sessions together. There are a couple of comments coming in on the live chat. I don't know whether you want to address any of them.
Well, let me just finish the last real short piece then.
Go ahead.
In other words, when an employer has to reasonably accommodate employees' religious beliefs as it pertains to vaccines, because there are exemptions in just about every jurisdiction and context in the United States and religious exemptions in most of those, it would be really hard for an employer to say that they could not reasonably accommodate the occasional isolated employee who has religious exceptions to vaccines. Now, potentially they can argue that point, but I think there's a very strong, if not outright compelling argument in favor of the person who would have religious objections to vaccines. So that's sort of the end of that piece there. Sure, let's go on to the comments. What have we got?
We have a few. I think I sent them to you. Let me take a look at in the chat room. There was three examples of when a pandemic was declared, and therefore that means that the federal government would and the World Health Organization would have had a domain or what would be the appropriate word for that?
Jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction to make a broad law or for the 1977 swine flu, the 1991 Hong Kong flu, and the 1997 bird flu. And last year we had a pandemic, and it seems to have fizzled out completely because everything seems to be quite quiet.
Well, that depends on where you're listening, but go ahead.
That's true. That does seem is true where you're living. But for the United States, I think we have a lull. And
you know, I said listening because you said quiet, and it's you know my computer screen has been quite continuously loud about that topic, not about that there is a pandemic, because we now know there never was a pandemic by any reasonable definition of the word. It was declared a hoax. By, among other people, by the former chair of the Subcommittee on Health of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, a German epidemiologist, Dr. Wodarg. It's not that there was no swine flu in an absolute sense. There was, but it was a very mild vaccine, and the only way they called it a pandemic was by, or pandemic level 6, was by changing the definition to allow a really mild virus to get that designation, level six designation. And that, by the way, is the highest level.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, and many people I've talked to report the same, that if they hadn't had the information about there being a pandemic, you would never have known there was one. You know,
right. It was all a media that flu.
It was a media pandemic.
Media pandemic.
Yeah.
So that kind of answers the question that is on the chat room as to what is a pandemic, and who can declare it, and you know, how do they define it? It says that was
the
question.
The World Health Organization changed the definition over the objections of several major countries, including China, Japan, I think Australia, and some other ones. The U.S. was conspicuously absent from that list. But they changed the level, the definition when they did that, and then they were able to declare the swine flu pandemic a level 6 pandemic. That designation triggered contract clauses around the world for the sale of $18 billion of vaccines, most of which were never even administered. So it appears to have been just a major money grab, among
right.
perhaps other things. But there were some real important issues, I think, there in the comment earlier that you talked about with regard to who has jurisdiction and in what situation. And I saw a lot of confusion in that during the 2009 and 2010 pandemic, and I'd like to take a minute or two to address that, if I may.
Okay.
The question about who has jurisdiction, there can be situations when jurisdiction overlaps, but for our purposes here in the U.S., we're really talking about just maybe three or four different arenas, so to speak. We have local authorities, we have state authority, we actually in this country have a separate tribal authority for Native American Indians, and we have the international, the federal, and then the international authority. And the declaration of a pandemic by the World Health Organization, or the declaration of a national emergency by the federal government, both of which occurred with this recent swine flu pandemic, does not give those agencies authority over state residents. The World Health Organization and the federal government do not have authority, in my opinion, to mandate vaccines for state residents. And the give me a minute here so I can remember the name of the organization. It's an organization that does legal research for Congress, Congressional Research Commission or Committee. And they published some information about legal issues concerning the pandemic, and they corroborated or agreed with my opinion on that. I know there are other people who disagree with this, or I have heard of others who disagree with this. But and there are situations and circumstances where you can have an overlap of authority. But unless it involves international travel or clearly an international issue, the World Health Organization does not have jurisdiction to step in and do anything. Similarly, as long as it's confined to a single state, an internal issue within a state, the federal law can't jump in. And this is why the vaccine laws for state residents are all at the state level. If the federal government could mandate vaccines, I'm sure it would.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare workers are required to get a hepatitis B vaccine, but actually that's not a requirement. It's a recommendation because it comes from OSHA, which is a federal agency, and
mm-hmm.
they can't mandate a vaccine because they're a federal agency, so they recommend it. And so healthcare workers who are quote-unquote required or technically is recommended to get the Hep B vaccine can sign an opt-out form
mm-hmm.
and not get it. And further supporting this, my understanding was the CDC's push right after 9/11 to get the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, which is how do you handle emergencies and health-related issues with emergencies. They pushed that on states all around the country. If it was something that all they need to do is get it passed at the federal level and then the federal government could handle it all from there, I'm sure they would have done that or certainly tried
okay.
to. So, but there are places where the jurisdictions can overlap. And so there's two – the starting place is these are separate jurisdictions that deal with separate issues. In the U.S., interstate travel is a federal issue, and U.S. airspace is a federal domain. But on the ground, inside an individual state, not the federal government's concern as it pertains to infectious disease matters. Now, if there was a foreign terrorist attack using, you know, bioterrorism, that would certainly be a federal concern and federal issue. Having said that, any one of these different levels of authority can invite other levels of authority in, so that if we had an epidemic that was wholly contained within a single state, and that state declares an emergency, if it was threatening to cross lines to another country or another state, the state might very well invite or involve the federal health authorities or international health authorities. An example the CDC gave on their website, I thought was a really good one. You have an international flight that comes into an international airport, say in the middle of Kansas somewhere, you know, Topeka, Kansas or wherever, and it turns out to be an infectious disease issue. That issue situation right there, that hypothetical, could potentially involve all these different levels, state, local, state, federal, and international. So it will depend, you know, on the specifics. But the declaration of an emergency in and of itself by the World Health Organization does not give them authority to mandate vaccines for anybody. The federal government declaring a federal emergency doesn't an epidemic or pandemic doesn't give them the authority to mandate vaccines for everybody in the country. It doesn't work that way. At least that's my understanding again.
Can I ask one question about continuing with the concept of this foreign travel? For students entering the Peace Corps or traveling to third world countries, they typically get vaccinated or have to have a whole battery of vaccinations. And Dr. Bob says that they always get sick. Is there a mandate for them to, or is that get covered under what you were talking about in terms of employee-employer relationship?
If they are an employee within the definition of employee in Title VII, and my recollection is that's a fairly conventional definition, and I would have to go look it up and see, it may not cover them. And this is sort of interesting because I see this with a related issue to healthcare employees. I have people contact me where they are students in a college or university, and they're doing some kind of a healthcare program, typically, most typically, but not always, nursing students or pre-med students. And that line of work typically requires that they do clinical work in local hospitals as part of the curriculum. And all states don't even require vaccines of college students, but where they are required for college students, there's always exemptions, and most states have religious exemptions, if not religious and philosophical. And so as far as being in the classroom is concerned, it's a fairly straightforward issue most of the time. But when they get to doing clinical work in local hospitals, they're dealing with the policy of the local hospitals. And the Title VII that I mentioned before, employers, employees, doesn't really apply to students because they're not employees. And so they're potentially...
That's tricky.
It is tricky. They're potentially in a bind there. It's the most difficult area. Now, Peace Corps, and I'm embarrassed to say this, is that a private entity? Or is it a government...
government-funded
agency. So,
Peace Corps volunteers are employees of the federal government. They get 12 vaccinations to go to Africa, and most of them get one or more covered diseases anyway because the vaccine does not work.
So you said two key things there. You said employee and you said government.
Right.
So there are actually two laws then that can apply. Title VII could very well apply because they are an employee, and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, if it's a federal employee, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, federal version of that act, would have potentially have some application as well if they have religious objections. Now, they don't you know, a lot of people have religious and non-religious objections.
Right.
But if they have qualifying religious objections, then probably those laws would apply. I mean, every case is going to be, you know, unique, and you need to look at
the
facts.
So you're saying that they might have a way to have an exemption or a waiver due to Title VII for persons who are going into the Peace Corps, or I'm not sure if that applied for the people who are students doing clinical work in a hospital. You said they needed to be governed by the hospital's own rules. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll just say that's a tougher arena to deal with. And in some cases, there's going to be law that applies. And in some cases, at least as far as I know at this point, in some cases, there isn't law that applies, or it's difficult to make the argument that there is law that applies. Anytime there's lack of clarity, I think the long-term solution is legislative, that we need to get laws passed that directly address the issue. When I talk mm-hmm. about using Title VII and employers have to reasonably accommodate their employees' religious beliefs, that's kind of a general concept. There's nothing in Title VII that mentions vaccines. So you have to make a legal argument under that, and there's... Mm-hmm. Because it's not directly, the issue, specific issue isn't directly addressed, it's a little bit easier sometimes for people on the other side to mm-hmm. either come up with an argument, or even in the absence of an argument, just say, well, we don't care. And in other words, those people are in the position sometimes of saying, in effect, so sue me, whether or not they think they have a counter argument. And that can put the burden back on us. And I see this in the healthcare arena. Most of the healthcare employees I've worked with have been successful with their exemptions, I'm happy to say. But every once
That's
in a while,
good.
I get...
I'm glad to hear that. I wanted to also mention, since you said that, you know, part of this show is really advocacy, education, and awareness, letting people know what kind of legislative involvement they can get into. And part of that is being informed. So people should... maybe take a look at your ebook. There is a link on the HWC website to find out where that is. The ebook provides information that people in every situation will need to make an informed decision about these exemptions and waivers. It will help those people who are interested to determine whether or not they can get through the vaccination exemption maze on their own, or whether you actually do need an attorney like yourselves to be your advocate. The most common questions regard religious exemption issues, and each state has its own statutes and regulations, and therefore the individuals must contact their state agency to find out what their laws are. We want to help people to understand and exercise their rights to learn the limitations of the legal system. And once they become learned, then they can join with others to take action. The development of this, we haven't talked about the advocacy portal today, but there is one, and we can direct people on the blog to that. In fact, people are so interested today about taking care of their body and their health that we even had a lot of interest in what do I do about my pet? And that's another thing. I mean, we didn't talk about travel and taking your pet and whether they need to be vaccinated. But we're going to have a special guest sometime in the future who will give us a total show all about pets and keeping them healthy.
Yeah, on the legal end, there are actually, at least in my experience, very few questions about exemptions and waivers that are short answer. And the international travel one, at least on the question of the travel generally, without getting into employer-employee issues, is fairly straightforward. You know, yellow fever for certain countries, that's all that's required. But the pet one legally is even shorter, I'm sorry to say, only because I don't like the answer, because I get the question periodically and have, you know, over many years, hey, how do I, you know, avoid vaccines for my pet? And the answer, sadly enough, is that pets are considered chattel or property under the law. They don't have religious beliefs. or philosophical beliefs, and there aren't any exemptions that I'm aware of anywhere for pets. Now, I will say that a few weeks or months ago, I saw that there was a proposed law in California looking for a medical exemption for dogs. So there are people who are certainly aware that the vaccine issue is just as much an issue for pets as it is for people.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people consider their pets their children, so they are very dear to their hearts, and they want to keep them for as long as they possibly can. And we know that vaccinations are detrimental to the animals. Therefore, maybe this issue is going to be coming up more.
Well, I hope so. I think, and absolutely, pets are people to some people, or a close equivalent, and very dear. And if you can extend your personal beliefs as an adult to your children, why can't you do that to your pets? And, you know, so I think there's some valid questions and concerns there. Of course, the flip side of that is, from the conventional infectious disease perspective, is about safety of people and animals. And but I believe that if we look at the pet issue in the same way that more and more people are doing with the adverse events and alternatives, events from the vaccines and all effective alternatives for pets, that we would see there probably are safer and more effective ways to deal with the same issue in pets, just as there is with humans, in my belief, and I'm sure yours too, Debbie. And we should have the right, not necessarily to just forego vaccines and let our pets get sick or risk getting sick, but to choose other more effective alternatives that don't have the severe adverse effects. Mm-hmm. On, you know, and most particularly the adverse effect that would have on the pharmaceutical industry profits if we actually did use something that was medically and scientifically safe and effective. So
it always comes back to money. Well, I think we're just about out of time for today, and just let's kind of tie it all up and conclude a very brief summary of what we've learned today so that we have it in mind. And next show, I think we want to talk about the issues that have come up recently in your practice. That might be an interesting topic.
I'd be glad to. And there's been some real interesting ones, as you know, in the news as well. So perhaps
right. Let's talk about that special kind of, well, I'm calling it a spoof, but it's really a sting of the FDA, and there's lots of cartoons going on about it, and I'm leaving that as a mystery to the listeners, and they're going to have to listen in to find out next week what that sting is all about. And please just tie up today. Well, we only have 1 minute left, so let's see. We talked about travel to foreign countries and the fact that we have to abide by the international laws. There are no international laws specifically except for the yellow fever one, and that I'm really out of time here. I'm going to have to summarize it.
Well, there's a lot of information on
show.
A lot of information on all of these topics in the ebook, so I encourage people to consider purchasing that to support both this show and Debbie and me in the work that we do, but also to inform yourselves.
Okay, we're going to sign off and see you next Thursday. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Allow our souls to shine, reaching for the great new love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be unfurled. One by one, we are changing the world. Your truth be unfurled.